appreciate your being here this morning and your interest and desire to study the Scriptures. We'll continue this morning our study of some introductory thoughts about perhaps one of the least studied portions of Scripture that we have. I know I'm safe in saying that as far as the New Testament goes. The book of Revelation is too often overlooked or disregarded because of the effort it takes to study that book. And so we have entered into that study as of January 1 this year, and I beg your patience. I say this every week, and I'll continue to say it. We are spending a lot of time on introduction, on an introductory material for this book. That's important with any book, but it's even more important with Revelation. And so we've been on it 3 weeks. Today is our fourth week, and we have at least one, if not two more weeks after today to talk about just the introduction, just to set the groundwork for our study. And then we will, I promise, Lord willing, get into the chapter by chapter study. Although, as I've said before, it's not going to be word for word, verse by verse, break it down. We're taking an overall view of the book. But we'll talk about those sections that raise the most question, the mark of the beast and the sea beast and the two witnesses and so forth. We'll talk about those things in time to come. But I think for us to really have a chance of understanding them, we've got to have some good background and good foundation. And so that's where we are as we are involved in our study today. I've got a map up here that we'll come back to in our class today and even look at the seven cities that the book is addressed to. And we also have on this map the island of Patmos here. And of what importance that is because that's where John wrote the book from. He was in exile on the island of Patmos here. We'll talk about that today as we get into that emperor worship. And incidentally, I was requested to provide outlines, and I'm trying to do that as we go through, and I hope that's helping you somewhat. But let's talk a little bit here about, we'll review just very briefly about some of the things we talked about last week, and then we'll get on into some new material today. And the first thing I want to note is this. We noted this last week. We can understand, and this is on your outline that was provided for today, we can understand the book of Revelation even though we might not understand every sign and every symbol. And I've said before, you're going to ask me questions in here that I can't answer. And there are signs and there are symbols here that there would be considerable disagreement on what exactly they mean. But let's don't try to get hung up on those little details and miss the big picture. And in fact, that's the second point I want to make. Remember, we've referred to this as the book is written as a great drama. We don't want to try to get hung up on the little details of every scene that's described and miss the big picture. Will those little details have meaning? Sure, I'm not saying they don't. But the fact that we can disagree and have some conversation about what each one of them means, sometimes we can get so hung up in that we miss the big picture. So we want to think of this as a great drama and look at the scenery and how John describes the vision and see if we can gather the big picture. And lastly here, I think it's very important for us to determine the meaning that the book would have had to the first century Christians to whom it was written. And remember, I referenced a book last week that was by H.B. West Jr., I believe is his name, that was that Gospel Advocate published it back in maybe the mid-90s, a collection of his lectures after he was deceased, that says Revelations Through First Century Glasses. That's the name of the book. So we have to go back and see what meaning that this would have had to those at that particular time. And again, the book here that we talked about the geography of the region here and these seven churches of Asia. Remember, I told you the acronym here on how to remember it, ESP, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos. And incidentally, on this map here, this is called Pergamum. And some renderings is Pergamus, but it's just a different way.
Singular and one's plural.
Well, I don't know that there's a plural city there, but it's there's two different ways that that's spelled. So you got ESP here, and then TSP, Thyatira, Sardis, and Philadelphia, and then L for last, and that's Laodicea here. Now, those were not the only seven churches in Asia. As a matter of fact, very close to Laodicea here is the city of Colossae. And we have the letter to the Colossian church there. So Troas is up here. Hierapolis probably had a congregation. I don't know. There were others here in this area. We'll talk more about this later on. But those seven churches there are representative in nature. We'll talk about that a little bit later.
Do you know if there was one in Rhodes?
I do not. I do not. I just know that these seven here were not the only seven churches in this area here, so they had some representative function here. We'll talk about that when we get into chapter 2 and chapter 3. Again, the island of Patmos here, where the book was penned from, or the vision was received. The author, we talked about this, the author, the very first line of the book says the revelation of whom?
Jesus Christ
to his servant John. So sometimes we refer to the author as being John. If we do that, remember that that's only in the stenographic sense. John was just the transcriber, if you will. He was the writer, but the author of the book, God gave it to Jesus Christ, that gave it to his angels, that gave it to his servant John, that wrote it to the first, to those seven churches of Asia. And to whom else is it written? All of us. In verse 3, it talks about to blessed is the one that reads and hears and understands and keeps these words, etc. And then on over in chapter 2, verse 7, we also see that he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So that makes us recipients as well. Let's talk just briefly here a little bit about John. I'm going to give you from time to time different schools of thought here. I have always just assumed that John that's listed here in Revelation is John the Apostle. Now, let me say that that's where I think the bulk of the scholarly folks would stand, with that being John the Apostle. But there are people that say that this is not John the Apostle, and I'm going to give you the reasons why. If you look at the Gospel of John and the letter to 1 John, they both began very similarly. The Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. If you go to 1 John, it talks about that which was in the beginning, which we've heard, we've seen, we've felt, we've handled. So very similar ways of beginning. Revelation's different. Also, in the Gospel of John and the letters of John, he never identifies himself. What does he refer to himself as? The one whom Jesus loved. He never refers to himself as John. But yet here, in the very first verse, we have him listed as John. I'm giving you the reasons why some people say this is not the apostle. But most people think that it is. And in fact, the reference to Patmos here down in verse 9 that we talked about earlier, and we know from secular history, John was exiled to Patmos. And so that was one of the reasons there. Many of the early writers, we referenced Irenaeus before. And incidentally, I brought a book from my library home, a couple of them. I have a dictionary of early Christian beliefs that I used last week. You're probably familiar with the book Josephus. Josephus was written there about the same time as we're talking about here, and it's a secular history book. It's not inspired, but it's interesting to read Josephus' account about the antiquities of the Jews and so forth, and fascinating stuff written by a non-inspired secular historical writer about some of the things that's happening in the Bible. Eusebius is another book that's very similar to that. Eusebius was written about 260. A couple of hundred years later, but this is probably the book on church history, on the early years of church history. Well, in Eusebius here, page 107 of this particular book, Irenaeus is quoted and saying that it's John the Apostle. Justin Martyr in A.D. 140, Tertullian, and others have said that it was John the Apostle. Now, let me take a little side note here. Remember, Irenaeus had a special relationship here. What was that? Do you remember? Irenaeus was the student of whom? Polycarp. Irenaeus was born about 35 years after Revelation was written. But he sat at the feet of a scholar named Polycarp. Polycarp sat at the feet of whom?
John
the Apostle.
He's reputed to be the last person living to ever have seen John.
Okay. We have a lot of things that Polycarp has said, and we'll talk about him more, especially how he died. I'm going to mention that here, maybe even into some of the historical stuff that we talk about today. But here we've got someone that was a student of Polycarp, that was a student of John the Apostle, that says John the Apostle wrote the book. That's pretty strong evidence right there. So
Polycarp is reputed to have heard John preach after John had been pardoned by the emperor that followed Domitian.
Right.
That was Titus.
No, it was Nerva.
No, it was Titus.
No, Nerva followed Domitian for 2 years. We'll talk about that, okay? We'll talk about that. So anyway, I don't want to spend any more time on that. It's not critical to our understanding. It's inspired writing. But most people do say that it's John the Apostle. We talked about the word signified in verse 1. Save mino, the Greek word there. We talked about the recipients. We've already mentioned that today. I want to talk just a little bit more about the date. I think that's where we were last week, was it not? When we ended class last week, we were talking about the date when it was written. There are two main thoughts on the date here, and I gave these to you last week. One is 68, A.D. 68, 68 to the spring of 70, somewhere in there. And the other I'm going to call A.D. 95, 96, somewhere in this area here. This right here is what we're going to, this is the approach we're going to take over here. Most conservative folks would hold this opinion at this time. But there are those that think it was written in A.D. 68. Now, why is it important we understand that? Those that hold this school of thought here think that the book of Revelations was pointing toward the fall of Jerusalem that occurred in A.D. 70. So it matters on which one of these two you hold to on how you interpret a lot of the things that we have as we go through the book. A.D. 70, fall of Jerusalem here. This one, we'll talk about the different ideas associated with how we interpret this here maybe next week or certainly the week after that. So the early church fathers. Hey, let me make one point about this. What was the one reason right here that I told you these people hold to? Do you remember? You have that in your notes? There's a reference in chapter 11, verse 1, to the temple of God. And those people that hold to this view say the temple was destroyed in AD 70. So it's got to be written before that if you're talking about the temple of God. But also remember that we got other places where the temple doesn't represent a physical edifice, but it represents what? The church. In fact, in one place in 1 Corinthians, it talks about we are the temple. This body is the temple of God.
Well, we are the church.
And, well, but singularly there, we be singular are the body, and then in a corporate setting or a plurality there, the temple would be the church. Let me give you just one quick reference here to refute that, even in the book of Revelations. If you look at chapter 3, verse 12, we're talking to the church in Philadelphia here, and we'll look at this later. But I want to make just one little point here at the beginning of verse 12. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Now, is there any question in anybody's mind that we're talking about the physical temple? And the Christian who overcomes these temptations and these persecutions are going to be made a physical pillar in the temple? No, we've talked about figurative language, see. So when he says the temple of God here, that doesn't mean necessarily that physical structure that was destroyed in AD 70. I'm just telling you that that's the main point that the people who hold this view right here hang their hat on. Carrie.
You got an obvious discrepancy between 1 and 9, where John's on at Patmos. I mean, John being referred to as a Patmos, when you've got the idea that he's exiled, that's going to be long after AD 68. And you know, that obviously
right.
harmonized.
Right.
One.
Right. Well, I want to throw some of these things out so that if you're talking with someone or someone brings this to your attention, there are those that hold to this school of thought, but the vast majority would be in this camp right here. And let me tell you just a few of these reasons again. Again, the person at the top of the list is Irenaeus here. Let me we'll just save the reference in the book there. Clement of Alexandria. Origen, Eusebius, Irenaeus, several of the early church fathers said that the book of Revelation was written near the end of the reign of Domitian. Domitian reigned from 81 to 96. And it was written near the end of the reign of Domitian, and that's the reason we put it here probably somewhere around 95, 96. The other reasons here for that. But if you're interested in more, I've got some other material here, but I think we'll just move on beyond that. I'm going to skip on your outline, the purpose here, and do it last today. I want to go down to the theme because I want to make two references there. The first one I think we've already noted. The theme of the book is found in the latter part of verse 10 in chapter 2. Very familiar part to us. Verse, maybe one of the more quoted verses in the book. Be faithful until death, or unto death, some of the older versions say, and I'll give you a crown of life. Not just to the point of death, but through the point of death, if it includes that, unto death. That's one of the verses that we marked as the theme. The other one is found in chapter 17. We've already referenced this one time, but I've got a couple of additional notes I'd like you to make here at this point. Chapter 17, verse 14. The A part of verse 14 is really the summation of the book. It's the theme of the book, if you will. These will make war with the Lamb. Oh, I want to take a side note so bad right here. Remember I said there are those who say that John the Apostle was not the writer because the book doesn't begin like John's book does. But there's also those who take that exact same argument and say it's because of what's written in the book that John the Apostle was the writer. And here's one of them. John refers to Christ as the Lamb. And there are several. Logos is another Greek word that's used in the Revelation and also in the Gospel of John. So there are some similarities between the construction of the Greek that do make you think that it's John the Apostle. Okay, so here's the theme. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. That's the Greek word nikao. Remember us talking about that. Overcome. That's the key word, nikao, the key word of the text. But I want to finish with these two thoughts here. You've already got that part marked, the A part. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. I've got out in the margin of my text, the outcome has already been decided. Isn't that great? Isn't that comforting? Isn't that really what the book is about? Yay, that's the reason this is the theme of the book. You know, we're in all this conflict, and there will be more conflict as long as the world stands. But the Christian can take comfort in the fact that we already know the final result. It's like watching a football game that you've got taped on your DVD and you've seen it a million times and you're watching that game, already know how it's coming out.
We won.
We won. There you go. And I told you to write that exact phrase at the end of your book. Go to the very end of Revelation 22 and down at the very end of it, write, we won. Because you already know the outcome. Okay, so now here are the other two things I want to point out.
The last verse of Revelation is a rainbow in the sky. The last verse of the Old Testament is gloom.
That's a good point, too. The Old Testament does end on a negative note, the New Testament with positive hope. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. Why? Why? Read the B part of the verse. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And we're going to talk about this today as we get into this emperor worship idea. But Lord of lords, that has to do kind of with a master title, even maybe religion, worship, Lord, Lord, Master. He's Lord of lords. Masters and slaves may exist everywhere, but he's above all. He's Lord of lords. And politically speaking, for those emperors of the day, he's King of kings. There will be lots of kings that exist. But the reason the Lamb is going to overcome is because the Lamb is Lord of lords and King of kings. Amen? Amen. And then thirdly here, I want us to note in this verse, and those who are with him. Now the Lamb is going to overcome and the Lamb is going to win. But not only will he overcome and will he win, but he's going to have a team. He's going to have those with him. Now, how does he describe those with him? They're the called, the chosen, and the faithful.
And those whose robes are washed by.
All right, listen to this. Those who are called, if you want to cross-reference here, 2 Thessalonians 2:14. We've talked in times past about what it means for a Christian to be called, the called, according to his purpose. The chosen, Ephesians 1:4, when you're talking about the blessings found in Christ, it calls us the chosen. And those who are faithful, cross-reference the verse we just left in Revelations 2:10, because we got to be the ones called and the ones chosen. But we got to remain that way. We got to remain that way. Those who are faithful unto death. And if we're the called and the chosen and the faithful, then we too will win and we too will overcome. Okay? Now, let's go back to the one that I overlooked here. And that's the one where we'll spend our time today. And that is the purpose. If you've got the handout for today, this will be the outline that we want to follow. The purpose. Why was the book of Revelation written? I think it's really, really, really important that we understand this as we begin the study of Revelation. Why was the book of Revelation written? Bill.
There have been many books. People were becoming very weak. They had seen all of this stuff going on that Satan seemed to be winning out on every area. And it was necessary to write and to encourage all the saints that there is a final day coming, a day of reckoning in which it will turn out for the best.
It's a thrilling study, and I think you're going to really, really benefit, as I have, when we start talking about opening one of those seals and seeing beneath the altar the souls of those that were slain. And so we need to talk about the emperor worship. We need to talk about the historical setting of what's going on to fully appreciate the persecutions and other things. Larry.
The persecution of the Christians on the mainland was just horrific at that time. And I think John was writing to encourage them and keep them keeping on, be a good faith.
Right. Well, as I've written on your sheet here, to understand the book of Revelation, we must have understanding of the historical events of the time. The short answer to the question, okay, what's the purpose? Why was it written? To encourage the church during a time of persecution. But we want to develop that a little bit more. Let's talk twofold here. I want to talk, first of all, from a biblical historical setting. And then we're going to talk about the emperor worship, which is the secular history side of it. But biblically speaking, we need to get some understanding of this as well. I've got three dates here listed that I want us to look at. Now, if we go back to this. Remember that when we... Back this. Remember when we talked about these cities right here, we're going to talk more about them as we get into chapter 2 and chapter 3. But I made mention of the fact that Ephesus here was a major city because it was on a major transportation road from Rome over here to the east. That road went through the city of Ephesus here, and so it was a major city. Well, Ephesus is really a major city as far as the Bible goes. When we start looking at these dates right here, first of all, AD 53 through 57. This is when Paul used Ephesus here as a center in the area of the province of Asia. If you look back at Acts chapter 19, I think it would behoove you to go there. Look at Acts chapter 19. In Paul, and in the back of your book, Bibles as well, you may find a map of Paul's third missionary journey. And when you find that, you'll find where it goes. Paul goes through the city of Ephesus and up through Smyrna and maybe even up through Pergamos. I'm not sure. But then it goes across over into Europe at that time. But I want to point out this verse in chapter 19, verse 10. It's just talking about Paul here, and it would be in this area right here, AD 53 through 57. It says, and this continued for 2 years, so that all who dwelt in Asia heard the word of the Lord Jesus, both Jews and Greeks. So again, if we go to this, Paul's using Ephesus here as a center here for 2 years, and it's quite possible during this time that all of these congregations right here were established. Possible. Don't know. Now, there are some that says that Smyrna was not established until AD 75, which would... That's some of the ones that say it couldn't have been written over here because Smyrna wasn't even established until AD 75. I don't particularly buy that because, again, Paul went from Ephesus here to Smyrna and up to Pergamos here as he went across over into Europe. I would think Smyrna probably was established at that time. But the point being, Acts tells us that Paul used Ephesus here as a center for a couple of years, and all of these churches here may have been established during that particular time. Now let's go down to AD 60 and 62. Now in AD 60, 62, Paul, not in Ephesus anymore, now he's in a Roman prison. And in the Roman prison, he wrote four epistles. What are they? What are they? Ephesians, Colossians, Philippians, and the letter to the individual, and the letter Philemon. So we've got those we commonly call the prison epistles, written about this time. What was the first one you said? Ephesians, and then Colossians. All right, go to Colossians chapter 4. Let's note another reference here that might be interesting as we study the book of Revelation. Colossians chapter 4. In the letter that Paul wrote to the Colossians, now he wrote one to the Ephesian church, he wrote one to the church at Colossae, and remember I told you on the map, you'll find Colossae down here very close to the church of Laodicea. So I know that those seven were not the only ones there. There was a church at Colossae. Colossians 4:16, read it with me. Now, when this epistle is read among you, see that it's read also in the church of the Laodiceans, and that you likewise read the epistle from Laodicea. There's a letter from the Laodiceans that was not preserved. God didn't choose to preserve that particular letter. But the reason I point this out is because there was a practice here of reading letters in written in a circular manner. A letter might be written to this church, and then it was circulated among other churches. And that's what we see, really, with the letter to the seven churches of Asia. It was to be circulated and read among many others.
Whatever one church needed, the other churches needed the same thing to some extent.
I really can't wait for us to get to the seven churches of Asia, because it's going to be a fascinating study to look at those seven churches and how we compare to it today. That's the great lesson that we'll take from that. Okay, now, well, I got one more here. 80, 70 through 95, at this particular time, now we leave the Apostle Paul here. He's probably been executed by this time. And AD 70 through 95, I just wanted to reference here that John spent much time in Ephesus at this point and in the province of Asia. He probably wrote the letters 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John to Christians there. And later in this period, we have the reign of Domitian. And that's some of the persecution that Larry referenced earlier here that we'll talk about today. There was intense persecution. John was banished to the island of Patmos, and the emperor Nerva in AD 96 to 98 released John back to Ephesus at that particular time. So as far as we know, that's where John died. Okay, let's talk now a little bit about the other side of it, emperor worship. Not going to be able to get through this, but we'll at least get it started. I've got on your handout here some emperors. Now, this is not all of them, but Julius Caesar, Augustus Caesar, Caligula, Nero, and Domitian. I want to just kind of give you a little history on how emperor worship developed. It's pretty interesting. And I would encourage you, if you like to read these kind of things, go home and do you some a Google search for Julius Caesar or emperor worship or some of this, and you'll read some of these. It's pretty interesting. Several years before Christ was born, there were a lot of wars and catastrophes going on. And out of this arose a great military leader, and his name was Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar began to calm a lot of things down to the point where people thought, you can't do that without divine help. Julius Caesar is perhaps one of the first ones to be recognized in a godly way by the people. Incidentally, there's a good story about Julius Caesar when he was a young man. He was kidnapped and held for ransom. His kidnappers wrote his people and said, we're holding him for ransom for 20 talents. Julius Caesar told his captors, he said, I'm worth more than 20 talents. I'm worth at least 50. They wrote back and held it and said, 50 talents. Well, and he developed a pretty good relationship with his captors during that time, but he told them this. He said, I'm coming to get you, and I'm going to crucify every one of you. And he did. But just before he crucified them later on, all of his captors, just before he crucified them, he remembered how good they had been to him and what a good relationship they had, and he slit the throat of every one of them before he crucified them. Now, what did that do? That hastened their death. What was crucifixion really about?
Long suffering.
So he had a little bit of heart. I mean, the guy still killed him, but he didn't do it, and he held true to his word that he crucified him. But he had a little compassion for the men that I don't want to see you suffer, so he cut their throat and hastened their death.
He never claimed to be God. That was his followers that made that statement about him.
Well, actually, I want to make that point the very next thing. In the year 45 BC, he rose to prominence to the point where there was a statue of him erected that read, "To the Invincible God." That's Julius Caesar. The next year, in 44 B.C., he was murdered. His successor was his nephew, whom he had adopted like his own son. And that person took his name, Caesar, and he became Augustus Caesar. All right? Now, in Luke chapter 2, verse 1, when we read the account of the birth of Christ, it says, in that day a decree went out from who?
Augustus.
Caesar Augustus. That's who we're talking about right here. Now he was the first emperor. He rose to prominence to the point where he became the first emperor, and he reigned until his death in AD 14. But now here's the deal. Remember that Julius Caesar had a statue that said to the invincible God. His nephew, Augustus Caesar, referred to himself as the son of God.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting? Now, this was the emperor that was reigning when Christ was born, and he referred to himself as the Son of God because he was the son, adopted son, of Julius Caesar. So emperor worship was established, and it began there during the days of Christ. So let me say this, and I think I put this on. Yeah, your world conditions. Go down to your world conditions on your handout. There were 2 points I wanted to make about the world conditions. One of them was a very much a plus thing. We've talked about that in times past. On the plus side, the Roman Empire ruling the world had many advantages. The languages, the roads, the military, and the peace that they had during this time, many advantages. And in fact, we've noted this before in our study of Galatians, in Galatians 4:4, where it says, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son to be born. When the fullness of time was come, well, we've talked about how the conditions were just perfect on a positive note. But there's a negative note there, number two. On a negative note, this was also during the time of emperor worship. The seeds of emperor worship were just getting started when Christ was born. And now Caligula here followed later on, and then Nero and Domitian, and these people really took to emperor worship. And also on your sheet there, I think I've got a list of the first three of ten persecutions, major persecutions, is found in Fox's Christian Book of Martyrs. How many of you have that book? Fox's Book of Christian Martyrs. You ought to get your hands on it. It's just a little simple book here, and it details a lot of this history in here. You've got the groundwork of emperor worship laid here, and we're going to just mention that in passing a little bit next time we're together. But this, it's important that you understand this, and I'll just say this as we close our class here. If you went back to the map right here, for some reason, this area right here, the province of Asia, was a hotbed of emperor worship. It was really a big thing in that particular area. So the letter to those churches that were undergoing those kind of things here in Domitian's reign would have been particularly comforting and helpful to them.
Caligula had his statue put in the temple in the holy place, and required all the priests that worked the holy place to bow every time they passed by that statue.
Because he thought he was a god, didn't he? Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.